Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Killer whales, also known as orcas, are amongst the most intelligent and socially complex inhabitants of Earth's oceans. They're apex predators, and many groups of them have highly specialized diets, ranging from other marine mammals to fish like salmon. Recently, a scientific study of the pathology reports on the strandings of more than 50 killer whales was released by the British Columbia Ministry of Agriculture and coordinated through the Sea Doc Society, a Washington-based program of the University of California Davis's School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guests were both integral members of the study team and joined us to talk about not just the ways that killer whales are being killed, but also about their fascinating and complex lives. Joe Gatos is a wildlife veterinarian and the science director of the Sea Doc Society, the UC Davis research program based, appropriately enough, on Orcas Island in the Salish Sea, the vast inland sea that goes from Puget Sound in Washington up through the San Juan Islands off the coast of British Columbia. We're also joined by NOAA wildlife biologist Don Noren, who specializes in marine mammals, especially killer whales. Joe Gatos and Don Noren, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So before we go any further, I'd kind of like to get some origin stories on you too. And I'd like to start with you, Don, because, you know, it's like the classic thing is you hear of young girls wanting to be a wildlife biologist and especially studying whales. And, you know, that's kind of like wanting to be an astronaut, you know, like everybody thinks about that and how cool that be. You actually get to do it. Could you tell us, like, how did you get into being a wildlife biologist who gets to study whales?
Yeah, it's a long story. I mean, I've actually really wanted to study or train dolphins since I was about 9. And then I became interested in their biology and mostly physiology, because they're mammals like us, and they, you know, they're warm-blooded, they breathe air, and yet they're underwater, surrounded by cold water, making a living and hunting and getting their prey that way. So I actually have a master's and a PhD from the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I specialized in marine mammal physiology. And I actually studied elephant seals, and I've studied dolphins and stellar sea lions, and I've focused on killer whales since 2003, when the NOAA Northwest Fisheries Science Center had a group that started studying the killer whales because of the endangered population of the southern resident killer whales.
And Joe, could you briefly tell us about your role and tell us about the Sea Doc Society?
Sure, yes. So Dave, I'm a veterinarian by training, but I've always been fascinated and worked with wildlife. And so I've been lucky to be able to do that. I've worked in Africa, I've worked all over the southeastern United States, and then took a job working with the Sea Doc Society in 2001, so almost 20 years ago. And we're really a program out of UC Davis, and we study the health of wildlife and ecosystems. And my focus is really in the Salish Sea, this area that connects Washington and British Columbia, where we have three types of killer whales. So my good luck.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, it's interesting to me, like, how does UC Davis get connected to such these interesting, diverse, distant places like in South America and up where you are in the Salish Sea?
Right. So you had Marcy Uhart on your show a little while back. And I think just like having things in South America or having things in Africa, somebody came to our school, asked the dean, hey, would you be interested in working in Washington and British Columbia? And the dean said, sure, we work all over the world. We can work on issues in that fabulous ecosystem as well. And that's how the program got started.
Cool. Well, let's focus on orcas, killer whales. What's the preferred term? Because I've heard both. When I was a kid, they were killer whales, and then they were orcas. What is the preferred the word to use?
I prefer to use killer whales, and Don may have a different feeling on that. But it, you know, the Latin name is Ursinus orca, and when people started falling in love with them, they said, oh, we shouldn't call them killer whales. That sounds so bad. And that epitaph was given by early whalers who called them killers of whales. And so, you know, some of them eat marine mammals, some of them eat salmon, some of them eat stingrays, you know, all kinds of different things like that. So I guess I've always just called them that and kind of have stuck with that. I don't know, Don, if you have a different opinion on that.
No, I'm actually of the same opinion. I just call them killer whales, and that's kind of the term I like to use. And I think you gave a great history of how the name came about.
Let's talk about their classification, where they fit in the cetacean realm, because they're really most closely related to dolphins, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. They are the largest dolphin. So they are related to bottlenose dolphins and all the other dolphin species. They're the largest dolphin. In fact, for some of the work that I do, I have used bottlenose dolphins as a model to try to get at some of the answers I have for killer whale physiology.
And there's, what I understand, there's three different kinds of killer whales, three different populations. And whether you could discuss this with us in a moment, I'll ask you about this. But could you go through that with us? The resident, transient, and offshore. What are these three different groups of whales that we have?
Sure, I can walk you through that. First, I just want to say that is specific to the Pacific Northwest. Actually, all around the world, there's lots of different types of killer whales. They're not all classified this way. So just talking in this general area, we have the offshores, which their name implies are often found more offshore. They tend to travel in larger groups. Less is known about them just because they're harder to study, but they eat fish and they actually eat sharks. And then we have the transient killer whales, which are the mammal eaters that Joe had mentioned. Those tend to travel in smaller groups. They have wide-ranging ranges, and they focus on marine mammals, anywhere from seals and sea lions all the way up to, you know, minke whales or young, larger whales such as gray whales or even humpback calves. And then we have the residents, and those are the ones that we are mostly concerned about. The southern resident killer whales are one group of residents, and they're fish-eating. The ones in this area tend to like salmon. But there's also northern resident killer whales that are their neighbors to the north that also extend their range down to some of the northernmost range of the southern residents here up to Alaska. And there's even some Alaskan residents. So there's these three general descriptions for these different types of killer whales, but they're also found all over. And again, these descriptions are mostly applied to the Pacific Northwest groups of killer whales.
And Dave, the biologists call these different types up here ecotypes, but there's populations. So the southern resident is one population. The northern resident is another population. And these populations really don't interbreed. People have looked at the genetics of that, and they're really distinct. It's fascinating.
So what would be an analogy with, like, for example, humans? Would these be considered like different races, or how does that work?
I would say it's even more than races. I would say that they're probably, some of them will become different species one day. So for example, the ones that eat mammals around here and the transients versus the resident, the fish eaters, those animals haven't been related, haven't interbred for, you know, what is it, Don, 250,000 years or 250 million years? I mean, it's a long time, right?
Wow.
It's a really long time. I mean, the tricky thing is killer whales in general are somewhat have low genetic diversity. But as Joe pointed out, the transients and the residents are pretty far apart on that gradual diversity of genetics that they have. So I don't know the exact year either, but yeah, I mean, there has been so many discussions about actually having them be separate species. There's a huge push to have them be subspecies. And this is evident too in Antarctica. Some of the killer whales look so different from each other. And so, yeah, there's, I would say, more of like a species subspecies differentiation rather than a race differentiation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've seen killer whales off the coast of California, in the Fort Bragg, Mendocino area. My son just saw one not long ago, right off the Pebble Beach golf course in Monterey. So, transients? Are those the transient population? Is that what those are?
You know, it's interesting because most likely, if you're seeing from the beach, they're probably not offshores. And yes, they most likely are transients. However, the southern residents have been observed in Monterey Bay, but I'd say all signs most likely point to transients. If it's a small group of whales, if they were hunting pinnipeds and you've seen them from the shore, it's likely to be them.
Tell us about the longevity. How long do killer whales live typically?
So it's interesting. I mean, the best data, of course, would be coming from the Center for Whale Research, which has photo ID'd these animals since the early 70s. So there was some speculation on how old some of the oldest animals were based on, you know, whether they were adult when they were first seen or if they were sprouting male, which is that big dorsal fin takes some time to grow. So you can kind of see it over time and estimate it a male's age by that. So I'd say, you know, typically males, they live a shorter amount of time. So basically for the known age animals, we're seeing males that are living in the upper 20s to mid 30s. There was a male that lived to his 50s. It was an estimated age, but given how males grow, it probably was the case, but he's kind of an outlier. That was J1. And then for the females, they live longer. Their expectancy is somewhere between 60 and 70. We've seen some females die in their 40s. And so that's probably the best estimate for longevity for these animals.
Wow. So they can live to be pretty old. That's interesting.
I always think of them like elephants or like people. You know, they kind of become sexually mature in their early teens. They grow up. The females stop having babies when they're in their, in their 40s. But the females stick around for a long time because they bring a lot of value to their society that they live in. And they live a long time.
Well, and you just mentioned a key word there, society, because one of the things I find fascinating about killer whales is they have one of the most complex social structures of any whales. Is that true?
Well, I would defer to Dawn on that as far as the most complex of any whales, but they have very dynamic social structures, and people are learning more and more. These southern residents, as Dawn was saying, they're known, you know, by photo ID. So every animal can be individually identified. And so you start to see really interesting things, you know, that the moms are kind of the leaders, that they're running the show, that there are different subgroups, that the cousins and the daughters take care of the new babies, that the females share food with each other. I mean, they're just all these little intricacies that can only really be figured out because people are watching them a long time. And they know them all individually. Dawn, I would defer to you on whether it's, you know, more intricate than, say, bottlenose dolphins or something like that.
Could you also comment on this matrilineal, this almost like matriarchal society that they have, their social interactions?
Sure. So as Joe said, you know, this photo ID study has been going on forever. Now we can see, well, not forever, since the 70s, but now we can see, you know, how important the family relationships are. And I would say that, you know, compared to other dolphins, of course, it's very hard to study lots of dolphins, but some of the best studied dolphins are actually coastal bottlenose dolphins because they also have photo IDs. And there's a long-term project that's been taking place down in Florida and also in Australia. And what's interesting about the killer whales compared to the dolphins is for the killer whales, you know, the mom is around. She keeps her female offspring and her male offspring with her all the time. And this is not the case in dolphins. Usually the mom will travel with at least female offspring, but eventually the male offspring will have to go away and they will pick up another male that's not necessarily related and kind of form this buddy system. But they don't have this huge group of extended family traveling with them the whole time. So the female killer whales play a huge role in keeping their group together. You know, they probably know where all the great fishing grounds are. They know where to travel. And so, you know, it is very interesting to see how permanent these ties are. And I'm not sure if it's quite the same with transients, because I think there's a little more fluidity with some of the offspring. They don't travel in these large extended families. Like you'll see sisters with each other in southern residents or northern residents, and you'll see, you know, the grandmas. And so it's a really important factor for their survival, I'm sure, or, you know, it wouldn't have been maintained because they're keeping the male offspring with them, which you could be worried about inbreeding, but they keep their whole family together for their whole life.
Wow. And the females live to be longer, isn't that true?
Right. So I said, you know, 60 to 70 or possibly more. The females do live longer. It's also interesting. There was a study, and I can't remember the author, so I apologize, but there was a study that showed that the males do better if their moms are still around. So often some of these teen young adult males will do much better in life and survive if they still have a mom that helps them out.
Wow, it doesn't sound very different from humans.
No, really, we all do better to have our mom around. That's for sure.
Or at least, you know, when you live with, you know, your spouse or whoever, you know, it's pretty well documented that men live longer when they live with women.
Yeah, that's great.
Something those whales understood a long time ago. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the lives and deaths of killer whales with wildlife biologist Don Noren and Joe Gatto, science director of the Sea Doc Society, a UC Davis research program based in the Pacific Northwest. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our examination of killer whales with wildlife veterinarian Joe Gatos from UC Davis's Sea Doc Society in Washington State, and Don Noren, a wildlife biologist from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Let's talk about the killing part of the killer whales, their hunting techniques, because they have an interesting array of ways they go about getting their prey. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too, because killer whales in general have these really diverse ways of getting prey. So some of the killer whales in Antarctica have learned to wash seals off of ice that's floating. You know, the transients up here will go after and tire out a sea lion, or, you know, a tire out and separate a mom from a calf of a large whale. And then for the resident killer whales, you know, they're eating smaller items. They're eating salmon, which, you know, they're actually going after the big Chinook salmon, but compared to their body size, they're still relatively small. So they travel in groups, and, you know, it isn't obvious. Of course, people are studying this right now, so we'll see if we find out anything else with these tags that people are putting on, that they are catching individual fish. But what's interesting about the residents, you will see them sharing fish. So that might be why those adolescent males are doing better when their moms are still around, because the mom is more likely to share with her young. And it's interesting that killer whales from all over the world have such different hunting techniques. Then you have the ones in Norway that kind of like swirl around schooling fish and then go in and slap them with their tails. I think this just shows how intelligent and adaptable killer whales in general are as a whole, and how they, you know, make these specialized little niches for themselves in their environment. And they use sound. And so it's important to know that, because, you know, it's hard to see in water, they have decent vision in the water, but, you know, light attenuates. So they really rely on sounds like bottlenose dolphins do. So they will use social calls to make sure they're maintaining cohesion with their group members, or like, you know, saying, let's stick together, let's spread apart, whatever, however you decipher killer whale speak. And then they have these echolocation clicks and buzzes where they're basically, it's a sonar that they can use to find the fish underwater.
Yeah. And that's another thing I wanted to ask you about, is whales are so interesting from, you know, their interesting vocalizations, you know, the sounds of the humpback whales. Tell us about some of the different sounds that killer whales use, and not just to, you know, locate prey, like the clicks and stuff like that, but also to communicate with each other. What are their vocalizations like?
So it's interesting that they vary by the killer whale type. So when we used to go on cruises, we were observing visually for killer whales, but we also had a hydrophone that we would pull behind us, because a hydrophone's pretty good at finding sounds in the ocean. much better range than our eyes or even eyes with binoculars. And so like transient killer whales, for example, they don't tend to say too much and they have very distinctive calls from resident groups because their prey can hear them and they're very smart. So you don't really hear transients too often until after they've made a kill. And their calls are very different. What's interesting about the northern, the southern residents and other resident groups is, so southern residents are composed of pods, J, K, and L, and they all share certain calls, but then there's distinct sounds that each of the individual pods make that tease them apart. So people that are really good at understanding and recognizing and learning different killer whale calls can just from a hydrophone alone, if they do their specific call to their pod or clan in northern residents, you can actually tell a pod without seeing them just by the sounds they make. So those are their social calls, and there's, you know, they're all labeled different names. But it's interesting that southern residents, they all share a couple calls, but each individual pod has a little distinct one that you can use to tease it apart from the others.
Wow. Wow. That's interesting.
And that might help them actually, you know, when it's time to find a mate to prevent inbreeding, for example. You don't want to mate necessarily with a really close relative.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool too, because, you know, you think about it, they can actually know that those other animals are around at a very long distance. And so, you know,
like how far?
Like miles, you know, depending on how much mm-hmm. other noise there is in that area. And again, you know, very similar to elephants. Elephants can communicate over miles. They rumble, very low frequency, goes through their feet and their ground, and they can communicate like that. But with whales, sound travels really fast in the water. And if there's not a lot of boat noise or other noise around, then, you know, they can know that they're around long, long, long before they can ever see them. Mm-hmm. Or detect them with the echolocation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's fascinating. And well, let's talk about this study that came out. The paper's title is Pathology Findings in Correlation with Body Condition Index in Stranded Killer Whales and in the Northeastern Pacific and Hawaii from 2004 to 2013. And this is the paper that caught my attention that Kat Curlin wrote about for UC Davis and why I contacted you. I'd like to know, first of all, how did this get started, this study in 2004?
Yeah, you know, in 2004, some of the populations of northern residents and the southern residents were just being listed as endangered or threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act or the Canadian Species at Risk Act. And at that time, we looked to see if disease could be causing a problem or could potentially hinder the recovery of these populations. And we were astounded at that time to realize how little we knew about disease in free-ranging killer whales. We had learned some from animals that had been in captivity and then some animals had stranded here and there, and there were some reports on that. But overall, there wasn't any sort of systematic studies. And so at that time, a bunch of colleagues put together a kind of a protocol to say, hey, if an animal strands, let's get as much information as we can. And then this study is really the amalgamation of over a decade of lots of different people all over the north, you know, the west coast of the United States, all the way out to Hawaii, responding to and then trying to learn as much as we can from these animals that died and then stranded.
And how many animals are we talking about in the study?
There are 53 animals in the study. And then there was some additional ones that Don was able to look at when we were trying to understand their body condition and how that related to disease.
And could you explain that concept? What is body condition index? How do you determine that?
So there's a lot of different ways you can look at body condition. You know, fat content, just the way the muscle looks, the way the blubber looks for marine mammals, or different measurements, morphometric measurements. And so I had done a lot of work earlier for my PhD to look at elephant, seal, and other pinniped body condition indices, basically looking at girths divided by lengths and trying to understand, you know, what is the best ratio of a girth to a length to really give a good picture of whether this is a healthy, well-fed animal or an animal that's not getting its nutrition or sick. And so for the killer whale paper in particular, there's a wonderfully large amount of data and samples that are collected during these stranding events. And so one of the measurements I did a ratio of a couple of different measurements, and the measurement that was in the paper is basically the girth in front of the dorsal fin, which is that fin that sticks out of the back, divided by the length. And so that gives you a relative fatness index. And so basically, you know, the larger the number, they're supposedly likely to be healthier because they're more robust, more girthy. And that's basically, for this paper, what that body condition index was.
Yeah, right. So they're not like emaciated and, you know, showing signs of malnutrition, things like that.
So some were. And so basically what we found in this paper is that we could see that the animals that were struck by a ship or died of trauma and, you know, decently healthy before that happened, had good, robust body condition indices compared to animals that died of malnutrition from a variety of reasons, or animals that had died of some sort of disease, like a septic infection or things like that. What we couldn't do is tease, and it could be sample size, but also we just could not tease apart, you know, a body condition index could not be used to tease apart if an animal died of an illness versus just simply not eating for other reasons. So the body condition index is good to determine what is a robust animal versus not robust. It's just not good at figuring out what happened to cause an animal not to be robust. But all the other samples that the vets took and analyzed helped to answer that question.
Well, can you tell us about some of the methodologies there? Like, what are some of the things that you do as a veterinarian or a biologist to figure out what happened with this animal?
Right. So when an animal ends up on the beach, it's a rare event. We know from the southern residents where they're all identified that only one out of five animals that dies ever is found on a beach. So in even farther north where there's less people, maybe only 3 out of 100 or 3% of them are found. So when it happens, you want to get as much information as you can. And the first step is to try and figure out, do we know who this individual is? And so people take pictures and send them to biologists that specialize in identifying animals. And then we have a whole just pages and pages of different samples that we'll take. Some of them are oriented to figuring out, why did that animal die? You know, was it an infectious disease? Was it hit by a boat? You know, is something wrong with its teeth and it couldn't eat? Those sorts of things. And then some of them just go for other studies that are going on. People want to look at this or want to look at that. Because if it's a rare event, we'll collect samples for that. But it's really like almost like a wildlife crime scene investigation, although a lot of times, most of the time, there's not really a crime involved. So you take samples, you're looking with your eyes to see, oh, is there bruising? Is there something else? Is there bleeding going on? Is something out of place? But you're also collecting samples. So just like every organ, the heart, the lungs, the liver, look different when you look at them with your eyes, they also look different under the microscope. So these samples will be taken, they'll be sliced really thin, and people that are trained will look at them under the microscope and they'll say, oh, this liver looks like it had a problem with it, or this heart looks like it had disease, and that was enough disease to kill this animal. And then sometimes you'll look at something and say, well, it looks like this animal had a bacterial infection because you can see bacteria and you can see the cells that fight that off, but you don't know what it was. So you have to take tissue and then try and culture a bacteria and then say, oh yeah, we've cultured the bacteria from every single organ, the heart, the liver, the lungs. This animal had an infection that was going out throughout its whole body. So then you feel pretty good. Oh, it was an infection that killed this animal. But you're also looking at other things, Dave. You're saying, was this animal, did it have so many contaminants in its system that could have affected its immune system? Can we do some immunological testing to figure out, had this animal been exposed to diseases before? So it really it's a arduous task cutting the whale up and getting the samples. And it's a long-term process trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together to tell the story.
So let's talk about some of the big takeaways from this study and primarily the role that we're having. You know, because I saw a lot, and just looking at some of the numbers, a lot of these were blunt force trauma from a boat strike. What kinds of boats are these? Are these like boats traveling at high speeds? Are these big ships? What is primarily the type of boat that hits a whale and causes this kind of trauma?
So there's a,
is there what?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to tell sometimes unless you see it happen. But with a lot of these whales that were looked at, they had signs of being hit by something really big, usually at one point. And so, you know, it would break some ribs and maybe break their back, or it would cause a whole bunch of bruising at one location. It has been recorded in the past, too, where animals have been hit by a propeller. And it's kind of cut them back. We actually had one case, was a mammal eating or transient whale. And all we found were just big parts of the skin. And when you looked at the edges of the skin, you could see that was a hit by a really, really big propeller. And then just some of that skin washed ashore. It was enough skin that the biologists could tell us which exact species that was. But it was a huge propeller that that animal ran into. So sometimes they're getting hit by the bow of the boat. Sometimes they're getting hit by the propeller.
Wow. And let's talk about some of the other environmental stresses these killer whales are facing from a variety of sources, whether it be, you know, pollutants in the ocean, you know, our runoff and things like that. What are some of those challenges that they're facing?
Don, do you want to give them the top three?
Sure, I'll give you the top three. So the risk factors, particularly facing the southern residents, are noise and disturbance from vessels and pollution. And, you know, our center has done a lot of work on looking at some of those contaminants that are persistent in the environment, such as PCBs and DDTs and PBDEs. So they persist and travel up the food chain. And so we have vessel noise, contaminants, and then prey availability. And so, you know, they love the salmon. The salmon is their preferred prey. And of course, we have a lot of issues with salmon here. So there's potentially reduced prey that is actually available. There's also some studies that have suggested they've gone down in size or fat levels, which is not good for an animal that it's like keying in on them. And so those are the three main factors, which unfortunately too, it's hard to tease. It's hard to really look at the whale. We do a lot of studies to look at all these risk factors, but it's really hard to tease some of them apart. So as Joe had mentioned previously, you know, if an animal has high contaminants, they might be more susceptible to disease. If an animal's not eating very well, they're also more susceptible to disease. And what we have seen for some of the studies that have been done on vessels is that the whales don't forage as often when they're surrounded by noise and vessels. So those are the three, and they're not easy to tease apart, and they all have, you know, potentially significant impacts to this population.
Is there any kind of discussion about creating sonically quiet areas for whales where, you know, we give them sanctuary from all this noise?
Well, there has been, so they do have protection from boats. They have, you know, regulations in Canada and the US and Washington, which has been, they have evolved to increase the distances away as more science has come in to show that, you know, oh, 100 may not be enough. You might have to go farther than that. And so that is one way to minimize the sound that they get. Also, Canada has gone and closed off areas that might be important to the whales altogether to vessels. And then on the west side of San Juan Island, it's been proposed a couple times to have a no-go zone, but that hasn't come to fruition. So currently in the U.S., there really isn't a place where it's going to be dead quiet for these whales. And also, I mean, it's not just the whale watch fleet. There's a lot of fishing vessels in the San Juans. And also, you know, it's a prime traffic area for transport of goods. All, you know, there's a major strait. And so there has been some attempt to try to at least slow down that, those larger vessels to make it quieter, because the faster a ship goes, the louder it is. So even though the vessel may be in transit for a longer period in that area, it's emitting a lower level of noise, which might be more beneficial to the whale. So those things have been done, but there isn't a place where you can just have dead silence.
Yeah, and sound, as I understand it from ships, especially large ships, carries over vast distances.
They do. I mean, it's interesting to hear recordings of storms and rain. It's amazing how loud nature is too. So, but I think, you know, if we can minimize the extra noise as much as we can, then we're obviously going the right direction.
Yeah. And you mentioned whale watching, and it's kind of one of those catch-22s. And, you know, in one sense, it makes people aware of the whales and, you know, maybe more likely to take action to conserve them. On the other hand, you're literally loving them to death. So what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting because in the area where the southern residents are, especially during the summer months or where they used to be a lot of times in the summer, it's been kind of hit or miss the last couple of summers. It isn't just the professional whale watchers that are out there. It is the general person who has a boat. A lot of people have boats out there who will just watch whales because they're there. So I don't think even if you took the whale watching, the commercial fleet out, you'd have any type of real reprieve for these whales because everyone else is out there too, possibly not behaving as well as the actual commercial fleet that is trained to drive around the whales. So, you know, the commercial fleet and the private boaters have the same regulations and it's all driven by science. So as the science evolves, maybe more will happen.
Let's take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with wildlife veterinarian Joe Gatos and wildlife biologist Don Noren as we examine one of the planet's most fascinating and intelligent creatures, killer whales. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guests are Don Noren and Joe Gatos. Noren is a wildlife biologist with NOAA, and Gatos is the director of the Sea Doc Society, a research program affiliated with the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine in Washington State. Both were part of a multi-year study on the probable cause of deaths in stranded killer whales. Let's talk some more about, you know, whale biology. Do we know, what are the numbers like around the globe now? What is the total whale, killer whale population? Do we have any numbers on that?
Oh, I don't know around the globe. I mean, some killer whales are doing really well. You know, the Antarctic groups are doing pretty well. And then there's, you know, groups in Norway. And it's hard because some of the killer whales are not as well studied as, say, the southern resident killer whales. And it has a lot to do with funding, and it also has a lot to do with geographic location and weather conditions. So I mentioned that there are a lot of different groups in Alaska too, but, you know, I've worked in Alaska on stellars, and it's not pleasant even in the summer on stellar sea lions. So it's hard to really know good numbers without good counts. But as far as the southern residents go, they're unfortunately down to 74.
74 total.
74 total. That's wow. Pretty small. That's, you know, when I started, it was not that number. It never, you know, got in the 90s when I was, you know, early on, but, you know, it's just been dropping.
This may be an unfair question, but, and you can just say, there's no way of knowing that, but I wonder what do you think those numbers were like, you know, when it was just the indigenous peoples that lived off the coast there? Like, say, 200 years ago, what do you think that whale population would have been?
You know, people have tried to estimate it, and I've seen different estimations, but again, it's really hard to figure that out. I think someone also attempted to do it via genetics, but that's hard too, because I mentioned before that killer whales are very bottlenecked in general, so it's difficult to get a population estimate from hundreds of years ago. So I think, you know, most people agree that it's, you know, 100 or greater than 100. You know, I've seen up to maybe 200, but, you know, they weren't more than 100 or 200, most likely, from what I've seen. And again, I'm not an expert, and it's really hard to get that number.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. So that, I when I asked the question, I knew it was probably unanswerable, but I just had it. I just wonder. Mm-hmm. Just, I just
wonder. We're not talking thousands. It was never likely to be in the thousands.
but probably more.
More than safe now. To say. I mean, it's been more than now, you know, when they started counting in the 70s, there was the reason why they started counting is because of the fishery on the killer whales, because of the aquariums. And live captures. And so they wanted to see the impact. And so even the northern residents were a focal group for that industry. And but the southern residents more so. And so you did see a dip in both groups. And then there was, you know, an increase as they stopped getting captured. They were able to increase the northern residents and the southern residents. The problem then was the mid-90s when there was a reduction, not just in the northern residents, but also the southern residents. And both of them had a population reduction. But differently, the northern residents were able to rebound from that, and they had increased their population, and they're still doing well. And the southern residents weren't quite able to make that rebound. And then they've had periods of decrease again. You know, so periods of decrease, a couple more whales are born, and then it's either depending on, you know, how far you look back on the population count or where you like draw your lines. Since the mid-90s, the killer whales have increased a little bit maybe, but then they've either flattened or declined. There isn't really any positive growth going on in the last several years.
Yeah. And how many, if you, I don't know if you know this or not, but how many whales now, killer whales, are in captivity?
I don't know outside of the U.S. Because there's captive facilities in Japan and Russia, and there's even animals in France. And of course, the U.S. has some. And I don't know. I mean, I think that's available online if you do enough sleuthing, but I don't know off the top of my head. I'm guessing, you know, I don't know. I think there's 20 something in the U.S. alone. So,
Well, I found it interesting that there are no documented cases of a killer whale killing a human, whereas there are many cases of that with sharks. You know, that it's rare, and it's not like they're out hunting humans, but it does happen. Whereas with killer whales, I've never seen anything like that. But in captivity, it's happened. And my first reaction is I don't blame them. They shouldn't be in captivity. That's my take on that.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated with that point too, that, you know, there's never been a human that has been killed by one in the wild out there. And, you know, you think that, boy, a lot of times we could look like a harbor seal, or we could look like a porpoise or a dolphin or something like that. But those animals are highly intelligent, and, you know, they see what's going on, and they know that we're not on the menu while we're out there. You know, not a reason that you'd want to go jumping in the water with them left and right, but I think it's something that you can definitely hold being comfortable when you're in your kayak and they're just a couple feet away from you.
Yeah, I'd rather have one of those next to me than like a great white shark, for example.
Definitely.
Okay, so but before I let you guys go, what are some of the big unanswered questions, things that you are working on now about killer whales, especially in your area up there?
Well, there's a lot of people doing different things in the group that I work in, but recently I've been working on contaminant transfer from females to calves, because we know that they have a high load of contaminants, those persistent organic pollutants I talked about. And also we know that they are passed in the lipid-rich milk because they have an affinity for lipid, these contaminants. And so what's interesting about this is you can't really do that study in the wild. So I actually have been working with SeaWorld when they were still having calves, where we were collecting milk from the mom and blood from the mom and blood from the calves every couple weeks or a month, depending if it was a calf or mom, on what stage of lactation or pregnancy was. And it was interesting, the data that we're finding and writing that up now, is that the young animals are getting a very high dose of contaminants early on. Now, the SeaWorld whales are not as contaminated as, say, the southern residents. They are fed fish, but I think a lot of the fish is sourced from areas that are less contaminated, or they're eating lower on the food chain. But it is still the same physiology. So what is interesting to note is that these young animals that are born, they're just like baby, you know, human infants. They are more susceptible to illnesses. They are more susceptible to, you know, health effects. And so they're getting their largest doses of contaminants in the first couple months during the lactation, which can take place over a couple years. So that was an eye opener for me. And we already know that, you know, the contaminants are a risk factor, but it was really interesting to see that how these high loads from a first-time mom in particular that has not offloaded to any calves before might be really dumping a ton of these contaminants into their firstborn calf, which may have less of a chance of survival or maybe ill later in life because of this high load. So that is an interesting thing. There's nothing much we can do about it except for clean up our environment, but it is an interesting way to better understand how this risk factor is affecting not just the adults in the population, but the potential for reproduction.
Joe, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, Dawn's point is really good that, you know, these are chemicals that were made decades and decades and decades ago, and we don't really produce anymore, most of them, and they're still around. Just kind of shows you the legacy of what we've done. You know, we've been messing up salmon streams and returns with dams and blockages and things like that, and overfishing for hundreds of years. And I think one of the biggest questions right now, at least with the endangered population of the southern residents or the threat population of the northern residents in Canada, is, you know, can we do enough and are we doing enough to actually help recover these animals? I think everybody loves them. You're not going to find anybody that doesn't like a killer whale. They're like a big panda of the ocean. But, you know, we're trying to recover salmon. We're trying to quiet the oceans. We're trying to get contaminants out of the system. But the biggest question is, are we just running to stay in place like the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland, or are we actually making progress? And I think that's the sort of thing that a lot of people are thinking about now while we're making management changes. And it's really going to be a deciding factor. Can we keep these magnificent animals around? I sure hope so.
Yeah, and on top of that, of course, you got the added layer of climate change and all of the things that happens to put into play as far as the ocean's health.
Yeah, we depend on that ocean, but we haven't done a great job of taking care of it. I think we can do better.
Well, Don, before we let you go, what's your favorite thing about studying killer whales? What fascinates you the most? What do you love most about your work?
Well, it's been a while since I've been in the field, but honestly, I'm in awe every time I see them. You know, I did some vessel studies early on, and so I was out with them every day for a couple, like several summers in a row, actually. And I don't know, I just love how they interact with each other. I just love the beauty of it. And I love what I do because, of course, I've always had this fascination about how marine mammals work. But what I am proud of is that I'm using the science that I can do to try to, you know, provide data and findings to the managers. There's a management branch of NOAA that makes all the rules and regulations. And it's just so satisfying to know that I'm doing what I love. I get to see these whales and hopefully make a difference.
And Joe, same question to you. What do you enjoy most about your work, and especially in terms of studying killer whales?
Well, I think, you know, like Dawn, I'm just fascinated with these animals. Every time you're out there, every time you see them. I was scuba diving one time. I was doing some rockfish studies, and they were all around. And I was just listening to them under the water. You know, all of the complex conversations that were going on. And so I feel lucky, like Dawn, that I can study something that I think can make something better. You know, this paper finding out that we need to pay more attention to ship strikes and fisheries interactions, and then having people start to talk about how do we do that better. That's a great thing to be able to add value to something you already care a lot about.
Well, Don Noren and Joe Gatos, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your expertise on these just magnificent animals. You know, as far as, you know, I'm concerned, I can't think of a more magnificent animal on Earth than a killer whale.
Yeah, thanks for having us, David. I'm right there with you.
Thank you.
Now it's time for a teachable moment when, from time to time on this program, we have our producer, Matt Fiddler, one of my favorite students, ask me a question and see if we can answer it and make things a little more understandable for everyone.
Okay, Dave, this seems like a really basic question, but I don't know if I can actually explain it myself. And so why do leaves actually change colors from, you know, usually green to reds and yellows and then eventually brown?
Yeah, well, and it depends on the species of tree, but deciduous trees do tend to change colors. And if you've ever been to someplace like Vermont in the fall, it's quite spectacular.
Parts of Chico.
But to back up a little bit, you know, most leaves on trees are green during the summer, and it's best to understand what's going on there first. So there are pigments inside leaves. It's called chlorophyll, one of the main pigments. And, you know, the reason that you see green in the leaves is that those pigments are busy collecting sunlight, energy to pump into high energy electrons to drive the process of photosynthesis. And the wavelengths of light that the leaves are collecting are basically everything around green, not green. So they're collecting the reds and the blues. They're collecting the colors that are not green. So they're absorbing those. And what you see is the light that's reflected back to you, which is green. Now, in the fall, as the days are getting shorter, and so the trees grow this thing called an abscission layer that basically starts cutting off the leaf from getting its nutrients back into the tree, that pathway of nutrients between the leaf and the tree, basically. So what's happening then is the chlorophylls start to kind of fade and die off. And now you get to discover that there's other pigments in the trees. Those are called carotenoids, which are like yellow-orange colors, and anthocyanin, which gives you the red leaves. So depending on the combinations of those other pigments, as they start to come to the fore, and the chlorophyll starts dying back, then you start to see the colors, you know, those different colors, because now those are absorbing like green light and other forms of light and reflecting back to you yellows and oranges, depending on the combinations of those other pigments in the leaves.
So since it's no longer absorbing those yellow and reds, it's then giving it back for us to see.
Yeah, because basically photosynthesis is shutting down. So it's really interesting, but it's basically the pigments that are always there, but now that the chlorophyll has taken a back seat, it's those other pigments that are making you see those beautiful fall colors.
All right. Well, thanks for explaining that, Dave.
Sure.
If you have a question that you'd like me to ask Dave, leave me a voicemail at 551-BLUE-DOT. That's 551-258-3368, and you may get your question answered on the air.
Thanks again to our guests, Joe Gatos, the director of the Sea Doc Society, a program of the Karen C. Draper Wildlife Health Center from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. They're based on Orcas Island in Washington. And Dawn Noren, she's a wildlife biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio from beautiful and talented Northern California. If you missed an episode or want to recommend one, check out our archives and link to our podcast at mynspr.org. We're also on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.